听力课堂，听 class.com。
Unit 11, Section A. Since many of you are planning to study at a college or university in this country, you may be curious to know what a typical college course is like. What can you expect to do in a typical week? How many exams will you have?Will you have to do a lot of writing? What should you do if you have any problems? These are the questions I want to discuss with you today. First, let's talk about what your weekly schedule will look like. If you're an undergraduate in any field or major, you can expect to spend between 4 and 6 hours a week for each class attending lectures, no matter what your major may be. Lectures are usually in very large rooms,because undergraduate courses, such as Introduction to Psychology or Economics, often have as many as 200 or 300 students, especially at large universities. In lectures, it's very important for you to take notes on what the professor says, because the information in a lecture is often different from the information in your textbooks. Also, you can expect to have exam questions based on the lectures, so it isn't enough to just read your textbooks.You have to attend lectures as well. In a typical week, you will also have 1 or 2 hours of discussion for every class you take. The discussion section is a small group meeting, usually with fewer than 30 students, where you can ask questions about the lectures, the reading, and the homework. In large universities, graduate students, called teaching assistants or TAs, usually conduct discussion sections.If your major is chemistry or physics or another science, you'll also have to spend several hours a week in the lab or laboratory doing experiments. This means that science majors spend more time in the classroom than non-science majors do. On the other hand, people who major in subjects like literature or anthropology usually have to read and write more than science majors do. Now, I'd like to go on and say a few words about examinations.Most university courses have at least 2 exams, one in the middle of the quarter, called a midterm, and one at the end, called the final exam. Most courses also have occasional quizzes, which are smaller tests given every week or two. There are 2 basic types of exam questions. There are objective questions, such as multiple choice, true, false, matching, or filling in the blank, and essay questions,where you must write an essay or a composition in response to a question. Most exams are a combination of essay and objective questions. In some courses, especially in non-science ones, you might also have to write a research paper. A research paper is a writing project in which you choose a topic related to the course, go to the library, read several articles and books on the topic, take notes, and then write a paper about what you have read.You can see that the ability to write is extremely important in American universities. The final point that I want to cover today is what you should do if you need help in a particular class. If you're having a problem, you should make an appointment to see your instructor immediately. Don't be shy. Instructors plan to spend a certain amount of time each week with the students. They see the students in their offices during office hours.Instructors will almost always announce their office hours at the first class meeting. You can also make a special appointment to see your instructor if you can't go to his or her regular office hours. I might add that it's a good idea to make an appointment to see your instructor even if you don't have a particular problem. That way it will be easier if you need special help later on. So far I've talked about college course structure, about exams, about research papers,and about getting help if you need it. Let's stop here and see if there are any questions. Section B.
1. The noise in my dorm has gotten out of control. I must take the problem up with the dorm supervisor.
2. Frankly, I never expect more than just a passing grade in Professor Marson's test.
3. I wonder whether the team is going on to the state competition or has gotten eliminated.
4. After a 3-week dry spell, a day of rain would do little to relieve the drought.
5. I'm not going home for winter vacation because I have agreed to work as a research assistant here.
Paul came back to London last night from his trip to Hong Kong.
7. One of Allen's most popular books focuses on ideas that crime does not pay.
8. The lecturer was just getting to the heart of the matter when the class period ended.
9. Are you taking your girlfriend out to that fancy restaurant? You can't go like that. You'd better change.
10. David bought a $20,000 car, and that only took one third of his yearly salary.
6. A. People appear to be born to compute. The numerical skills of children develop so early and so inexorably that it is easy to imagine an internal clock of mathematical maturity guiding their growth. Not long after learning to walk and talk, they can set the table with accuracy, one knife, one spoon, one fork, for each of the 5 chairs. Soon they are capable of noting that they have placed 5 knives, spoons and forks on the table, and a bit later that this amounts to 15 pieces of silverware. Having thus mastered addition, they move on to subtraction. It seems almost reasonable to expect that if a child was secluded on a desert island at birth and retrieved 7 years later, he or she could enter a second grade mathematics class without any serious problems of intellectual adjustment. Of course, the truth is not so simple. This century, the work of cognitive psychologists has illuminated the subtle forms of daily learning on which intellectual progress depends. Children were observed as they slowly grasped, or as the case might be, bumped into, concepts that adults take for granted, as they refused, for instance, to conceive that quantity is unchanged as water pours from a short glass into a tall, thin one. Psychologists have since demonstrated that young children, asked to count the pencils in a pile, readily report the number of blue or red pencils, but must be coaxed into finding the total. Such studies have suggested that the rudiments of mathematics are mastered gradually and with effort. They have also suggested that the very concept of abstract numbers, the idea of a oneness, a two-ness, a three-ness that applies to any class of objects and is a prerequisite for doing anything more mathematically demanding than setting a table, is itself far from innate.
B. In some Western countries, there are many opportunities for adults who want to improve their lives. There are public schools you can attend. In the schools, you can find classes in almost any subject you want to study. You may want to learn to type, sew, paint, or fix TV sets. You may want to learn more about the trade you are already in. You may want to learn a new trade. You may want to get a high school diploma. You may even want to go to college. All it takes is time and effort. In many cities, there are adult classes in the public schools. You can attend many of these classes without having to pay money. In some schools, you may have to pay a small fee. There are also many kinds of private schools for adults. Besides schools, many industries and unions organize on-the-job training programs. In these programs, you hear about new ideas and learn new skills. Many large companies will send a worker to school if he or she has ability. Many job opportunities are offered to those who wish to work. It helps if you know more than one language. There are good jobs for interpreters and typists who know English and another language.
C. It is commonly believed in the United States that school is where people go to get an education. Nevertheless, it has been said that today children interrupt their education to go to school. The distinction between schooling and education implied by this remark is important. Education is much more open-ended and all-inclusive than schooling. Education knows no bounds. It can take place anywhere, whether in the shower or in the job, whether in the kitchen or on a tractor. It includes both the formal learning that takes place in schools and the whole universe of informal learning. The agents of education can range from a revered grandparent to the people debating politics on the radio, from a child to a distinguished scientist. Whereas schooling has a certain predictability, education quite often produces surprises. A chance conversation with a stranger may lead a person to discover how little is known of other religions. People are engaged in education from infancy on. Education, then, is a very broad, inclusive term. It is a lifelong process, a process that starts long before the start of school, and one that should be an integral part of one's entire life. Schooling, on the other hand, is a specific, formalized process, whose general pattern varies little from one setting to the next. Throughout the country, children arrive at school at approximately the same time, take assigned seats, are taught by an adult, use similar textbooks, do homework, take exams, and so on. The spices of reality that are to be learned, whether they are the alphabet or an understanding of the working of a government, have usually been limited by the boundaries of the subject being taught. For example, high school students know that they're not likely to find out in their classes the truth about political problems in their communities or what the newest filmmakers are experimenting with. There are definite conditions surrounding the formalized process of schooling.
D. Before the 1850s, the United States had a number of small colleges, most of them dating from colonial days. They were small, church-connected institutions whose primary concern was to shape the moral character of their students. Throughout Europe, institutions of higher learning had developed, bearing the ancient name of university. In Germany, a university was concerned primarily with creating and spreading knowledge, not morals. Between mid-century and the end of the 1800s, more than 9,000 young Americans, dissatisfied with their training at home, went to Germany for advanced study. Some of them returned to become presidents of venerable colleges, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and transformed them into modern universities. The new presidents broke all ties with the churches and brought in a new kind of faculty. Professors were hired for their knowledge of a subject, not because they were of the proper faith and had a strong arm for disciplining students. The new principle was that a university was to create knowledge as well as pass it on, and this called for a faculty composed of teacher-scholars. Drilling and learning by rote were replaced by the German method of lecturing, in which the professor's own research was presented in class. Graduate training leading to the PhD, an ancient German degree signifying the highest level of advanced scholarly attainment, was introduced. With the establishment of the seminar system, graduate students learned to question, analyze, and conduct their own research. At the same time, the new university greatly expanded in size and course offerings, breaking completely out of the old, constricted curriculum of mathematics, classics, rhetoric, and music. The president of Harvard pioneered the elective system, by which students were able to choose their own course of study. The notion of major fields of study emerged. The new goal was to make the university relevant to the real pursuits of the world. Paying close heed to the practical needs of society, the new universities train men and women to work at its tasks, with engineering students being the most characteristic of the new regime. Students were also trained as economists, architects, agriculturalists, social welfare workers, and teachers.
Section D. I was born of a working-class father, and the aspirations of many self-made men is to send their children to private boarding schools, to give them the best education money can buy, and one of the best schools in the country is Harrow. Harrow is one of those institutions, when I was there, which at that time were really geared to train an elite ruling class, so that everything was geared to that. And so team spirit and team games were really more important than the acquisition of knowledge. If you were good at games, you were considered to be one of the heroes of the school, and if you were good at work, then the chances are you would be derided and laughed at as a swot, or somebody who worked hard and studied hard, and that was not the attribute of a gentleman. So some games, like tennis, golf, were frowned on, and you were not encouraged to pursue those games, but you were more encouraged to play cricket, football, and harrow football, and so forth, because it required a team effort. You were one of a team, not an individual, and it seemed to me that the public school system actually ground out the individual. You fitted into a mould. You learned to accept certain standards. You never showed pain, for example. You didn't whinge about pain or discomfort, and schools in my day were not comfortable places. Tying in with the importance of games is the fact that you also had to be a man, and if people abroad think that the English gentleman is someone who is clean of limb, I can assure you he's not. I think most of us washed about once a week. In winter we used to, it was a mark of a gentleman as well, and being tough and hard that you didn't wear an overcoat, so this meant that in winter we would pull our clothes off and the whole lot came off, shirts, several pullovers and vests, and they all came off in one go. We then put our pyjamas on, and if the next morning was particularly cold, we'd just put the whole damn lot on over the pyjamas, so you'd see small boys with bits of about an inch or two of pyjama trouser showing out at the bottom of their grey trousers. But you went, in the end, if it sort of dropped to -10, you went around like little Michelin men with layers and layers of things on, but no overcoat. That was the sign of weakness.
Unit 12. Section A. High school and college students in the United States today, as well as others who plan to work in this country, have one important question about their futures. Will they find a job? There is no easy answer, of course. But let's look at some of the recent changes in the U.S. job market and see if we can make some predictions for future job hunters. A good way to begin is to look at the American workforce and how it's changing. The most important change has been the shift from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. Let's define both of these terms. First, a service economy is one in which most workers provide services, that is, they do something, like pumping gas into people's cars, for example, instead of making something. Generally, service jobs are grouped into five categories. 1. Transportation and utility companies, like the phone company. 2. Wholesale companies. 3. Retail companies. 4. Finance, insurance, and real estate companies. And finally, 5. Personal services, such as hotels, car repair, accounting, and medicine. Examples of people who work in service industries include your doctor, your hairstylist, airline pilots, and sales clerks in department stores. In contrast, people who actually produce things, like cars, furniture, or clothing, are part of the manufacturing economy. Now, the point here is that we have changed from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. The following numbers will show you just how much our economy has changed. 100 years ago, 80% of workers produced goods. Today, only about 30% do. Economists predict that by the year 2010, 9 out of every 10 workers will supply services. What has caused this change in our economy? Well, first, manufacturing industries are not growing for one simple reason: competition from Western Europe and Asia. Jobs in American automobile and steel production have especially decreased during the last 10 years. The number of service industries, on the other hand, has increased for several reasons. Because of technological advances, especially in computers and telephone communications, advertising, accounting, and other business services become important. Also, the growing number of married women who work outside the home has increased the need for restaurants and daycare centers. And, as the number of old people has grown, so have health care services. So now you know where the jobs will be, and you've decided to look for a job in a service industry. But wait! Because some economists worry that the service job explosion may create several problems. According to some studies, American standard of living might decrease because half of the service jobs pay low wages. For example, 3 out of 5 new jobs between 1979 and 1985 paid less than $7,000 a year. The pay is low because many of these jobs don't require much education or training, and many of the workers are part-time or temporary employees. Companies save money by using temporary employees because they don't have to give them health insurance or vacation pay. Such jobs give a worker very little security. The good news is that, as you can see in the chart, the fastest growing service job categories are the better paying ones, particularly in the technical and computer related fields. But these jobs require a high degree of skill and many years of education. So if you decide to look for a job in a service industry, and you want to be sure you'll make enough money, getting the right training and education first is the best way to prepare for the future job market.
Section B. 1. The government has taken many actions to curb inflation, but it is all to no avail.
2. Nobody will deny the fact that regular, moderate exercise is important for good health.
3. I have won a scholarship for next year. I can't believe it.
4. I'm absolutely no good at figures and shapes. Geometry is hard for me, but algebra is harder.
5. No sooner had he finished washing his car than it started to rain.
6. To keep the rooms clean and prevent fire accidents, cooking is not allowed in this dormitory.
7. Today is Thursday, and the new shop is supposed to open the day after tomorrow.
8. Linda's performance in the final test of psychology wasn't what I'd expected.
9. I'm going to get my tickets through that discount travel agency. They have some good deals.
10. How Larry managed to get a very high mark is really a mystery to us all.
Section C. A. In cities all over the United States, workers spend several hours a day in cars crawling along in traffic to get to offices many miles from home. They experience stress, waste time, and pay a lot for gas, car maintenance, and parking. Nancy Alley, a human resources manager, doesn't. She stays at home in her pajamas with a pile of resume, talking with managers over the phone and faxing in paperwork. Instead of walking down the hall to chat with coworkers, she emailed them. Nancy is a telecommuter, someone who works some or all of the time at home, and she is part of a trend. Since 1990, the number of U.S. telecommuters has grown from 4.2 million to 9.2 million, and by the turn of the century, 55 million people worldwide have been telecommuting. Highway congestion, the high cost of office space, reduced workforces, and lifestyle needs, all these factors contribute to the growth of telecommuting. What makes it possible is technology. Desktop and laptop personal computers, networking, video conferencing, fax machines, email, and multiple phone lines provide the fast and efficient communication required for telecommuting. Telecommuting can increase workplace flexibility and enhance productivity. At Georgia Power Company, for example, a pilot telecommuting project was so successful that the company decided to triple its number of telecommuters. The company reduced the cost of leased office space by $100,000 a year, increased productivity among the telecommuting employees of its customer service center, and saved the workers a combined 750 commuter miles a day. However, telecommuting is not universally applicable. Jobs and individuals must be suitable, and staff must be capable of managing telecommuters. In addition, technological improvements, such as high-speed modems, are crucial. Few people expect to conduct business regularly from a tropical island or a mountain resort anytime soon.
B. Work relations with other people at the place of work include relationships with fellow employees or colleagues. A major part of work or job satisfaction comes from getting on with others at work. Work relations will also include those between the boss and yourself. Management-employee relations are not always straightforward, particularly as the management's assessment of your performance can be crucial to your future career. There will always be matters about which employees will want to talk to the management. In small businesses, the boss will probably work alongside his workers. Anything which needs to be sorted out will be done face-to-face as soon as a problem arises. The larger the business, the less direct contact there will be between employees and management. Special meetings have to be held and procedures set up to say when, where, how, and in what circumstances the employees can talk to the management. Some companies have specially organized consultative committees for this purpose. In many countries of the world today, particularly in large firms, employees join a trade union and ask the union to represent them to the management. Through the union, all categories of employees can pass on the complaints they have and try to get things changed. The process through which unions negotiate with management on behalf of their members is called collective bargaining. Instead of each employee trying to bargain alone with the company, the employees join together and collectively put forward their views.
C. In an American office, the official workday starts at 9 a.m. This should really mean 9 o'clock, not 10 past or half past 9. I don't know about employees in your country, but some nations have a philosophy that you work when the boss is around, and any time he's not there, one can relax by reading the newspaper or whatever one likes doing in a personal way. Well, in America, one is being paid for your time. So employees are expected to find other work if their own desks are clear, or to help someone else with his or her work. But you never sit idle or doing nothing. Just as the saying goes, time is money, your employer owns your time while he is paying you for it. That is precisely what time is money means. And anyway, the boss doesn't ask more of you than he is doing himself. He will probably work through the lunch hour himself and even take work home at night. The employee's lunch hour should be taken within the period allowed, unless you are officially discussing company business, say, on a business lunch. It's the same, too, with the end of the day. I mean, work until the day officially ends at 5 o'clock, unless you are in an office where flexi time is the accepted practice. Flexi time refers to flexible working hours, that is, starting or ending work earlier or later. I know that that is very common in Europe, but here in the USA it is still relatively new. Certainly there are a million or so Americans on the system today, and the number is growing. Well, for the same reasons as in Europe, to keep traffic and commuting problems down, and as more women now work, it gives more family time. As to contracts of hiring in America, it's different in America from, say, Asia, perhaps Europe too, I'm not sure. We are more democratic, I think. It means perhaps that we won't develop such a permanent relationship between employer and employee. I know that in some countries people relax when they have once got a job, because they know they will almost never be fired, unless they do something awful. But I am not saying that the employer can just fire people in America. No, no, no. There are, of course, legal protections in the USA, so employees cannot be unjustly fired without good reason. Workers must do a good job, produce well, and get along with their colleagues, or they can be let go, as it is called. But it's rarely done without warning. It is important to remember that in the United States, you are a member of a business firm and not a family. It makes a difference. Well, I have heard people comment on the informality found in American offices, and this is certainly a little difficult for people who are more used to a hierarchical system to adjust to, of course. But there are some very formal offices too, say, in big banks, law firms, and major corporations. But in many establishments, the atmosphere is loose and easy, with a lot of joking and teasing and wandering in and out of offices among all levels of employees. Nearly all large offices have coffee wagons that circulate for mid-morning and mid-afternoon coffee breaks. But you should remember that although 15 minutes are allotted twice a day for relaxation and chatter, Many employees take coffee to their desks and keep on working. In small offices, the coffee pot is often on all day, and employees take coffee whenever they like, or they can make tea for themselves.
D. Telecommuting, substituting the computer for the trip to the job, has been hailed as a solution to all kinds of problems related to office work. For workers, it promises freedom from the office, less time wasted in traffic, and help with child care conflicts. For management, telecommuting helps keep high performers on board, minimizes tardiness and absenteeism by eliminating commutes, allows periods of solitude for high concentration tasks, and provides scheduling flexibility. In some areas, such as Southern California, Seattle, and Washington, local governments are encouraging companies to start telecommuting programs in order to reduce rush hour congestion and improve air quality. But these benefits do not come easily. Making a telecommuting program work requires careful planning and an understanding of the differences between telecommuting realities and popular images. Many workers are seduced by rosy illusions of life as a telecommuter. A computer programmer from New York City moves to the tranquil Adirondack Mountains and stays in contact with her office via computer. A manager comes into his office 3 days a week and works at home the other two. An accountant stays home to care for her sick child. She hooks up her telephone modem connections and does office work between calls to the doctor. These are powerful images, but they are a limited reflection of reality. Telecommuting workers soon learn that it is almost impossible to concentrate on work and care for a young child at the same time. Before a certain age, young children cannot recognize, much less respect, the necessary boundaries between work and family. Additional child support is necessary if the parent is to get any work done. Management, too, must separate the myth from the reality. Although the media has paid a great deal of attention to telecommuting in most cases, it is the employee's situation, not the availability of technology, that precipitates a telecommuting arrangement. That is partly why, despite the widespread press coverage, the number of companies with work-at-home programs or policy guidelines remains small.
Section D. The traditional American family used to have a working father, a housewife mother, and two or three children. But in the last 20 or 25 years, this picture has changed. Now we have many different kinds of families and living situations besides this traditional one. For example, there are many single mothers and single fathers who are raising children by themselves. There are married couples who decide that they don't want any children. Sometimes, adult children who have been living alone for a long time come back and live with their parents again. You can also find groups of older people sharing a house in order to save money. And there are many other examples of new types of families in this country. Why has the traditional family changed so much? Well, the reasons are both social and economic. First, as you know, the divorce rate is high in our culture. As a result, we have many single-parent families. Second, there is unemployment among young adults. If they cannot find a job, many times they return home and live with their parents again. But of course, the most important reason for the changes in the American family is that most American women have worked outside the home. In fact, 54.5% of all American women are now working or looking for work. This means that more than half of all American homes do not have a full-time homemaker anymore. With so many women working, our society has some difficult new problems. For example, who will take care of children and old people? Who will do the housework? Who will do volunteer work? Some people might say that these are women's problems, so women should be the ones to solve them. But more and more people understand that everybody in our society is responsible for trying to find answers to these problems. In fact, many companies are trying to help modern working parents, both the mother and the father, by creating flexible new policies. Here are a few examples. One example is that many companies now allow a woman to leave her job temporarily in order to have a baby. This is called maternity leave. The woman may receive part of her salary while she is not working. And of course, her job will be waiting for her when she is ready to return to work. Second, you know that big companies like IBM or Mitsubishi often transfer their employees to other cities. If a company transfers the husband, for example, this might create a problem for the wife, because now she has to find a new job too. Well, now there are some companies that will help the husband or wife of a transferred worker to find a new job. Another new policy is that many companies now have something called flex time. Flex time means that instead of working from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., as most people do in this country, a worker can work from, say, 6 a.m. to 3 p.m., or from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., etc. As you can imagine, flex time is very useful for people with children. Many of the big companies in this country now have it. Fourth, some companies allow their employees to work at home instead of coming into the office every day. Working at home is easy for people in professions like computer programming and telephone sales. Fifth, a few large companies now have daycare centers for the children of their employees. I've given you five examples of new company policies that are supposed to make life a little easier for working mothers and fathers. Let me repeat them for you briefly. Maternity leave, helping the wife or husband of a transferred worker to find a new job in another city, flex time, allowing employees to work at home, and daycare centers. However, it's important for you to understand that there are only a few large companies that can afford to help their employees with these kinds of programs. For most people, trying to work and take care of a family is still very, very difficult.